This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising? People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience? Visit stateofaudio.com to see Audacy's State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative. Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
All right, 9:09 now on this Wednesday morning. Temperatures continue to drop throughout the day, and we're going to talk this hour about this whole name, image, and likeness mess and paying college athletes. And there are so many questions that I would like y'all to text in with that I know you have at 504-260-1870. It's a morass is what it is, and Matt Brown's here to help sort it out, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. How you doing, Matt?
I am doing wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Good to talk to you again. Tell me about the Extra Points newsletter, please.
Sure. Extra Points is a newsletter that covers business, policy, and off-the-field stories that shape the college athletics industry. Whether you're a major school like LSU or an FCS institution or Division III, through original reporting and analysis and commentary, Extra Points digs into everything except the games themselves. That shapes how this industry works.
I don't even know where to start. If you want to start with context, Matt, and give us a background, or if you want to start with what 2025 could mean with a new administration and the House negotiations, you are best equipped to tell this story, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I think maybe talking about what's going to happen in the near future might be helpful. And many of your listeners who are college sports fans may have heard of a court case, the House v. NCAA, where there is a proposed settlement to this huge antitrust case that would allow schools to directly pay some money to their athletes. It's a cap of a little over $20 million. And the way that it's set up, if this is all passed and approved, a school like LSU could say, listen, we have this left tackle, and we're going to pay that left tackle $300,000. And we're going to say that he's not an employee. I'm just paying him for his promotional rights. So he can appear in LSU football commercials and on billboards and that sort of thing. But then rather than having to have the collective or some boosters or some third party do it, we'll just cut the check ourselves. And we can do the same thing for any of our sports, whether that's baseball or women's basketball or anything else. We will know if that settlement is approved by the federal judge in early April. And everyone right now is just trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to split up this money? How much of this money are we going to spend? Are we going to opt into this settlement? Can we afford to? Difficult questions for everybody from big schools to small schools to figure out over the next few months.
So that you said $20 million salary cap, right? Is that what you said?
Essentially. So it's like 20.4. We can, you know, colloquially speaking, we can say it's $20 million bucks.
Well, pretty soon you'll be accounting for every dollar. That's an old joke. So when it comes to that salary cap, to whom would that apply?
Great question. So schools, with the guidance that they have right now from the federal government, can essentially decide how they want to split that money up amongst their athletes. However they want.
This $20 million per school?
This is 20 million, up to 20 million per school. Yes.
Okay.
And that's important because there's no obligation to do the whole 20 million, right? LSU and everybody in the SEC almost assuredly will. But if you're Nichols, Grambling or any of the other FCS institutions in the state, you might say, I'm going to opt in, but I don't have $20 million. I don't make $20 million. Maybe we'll do $1 million. Maybe we'll just split any merchandising revenue with the athletes directly. Or you can go all the way up. Then the schools have to decide, do I want to give all of this to my football team and then risk everyone leaving my basketball program? How much should I give to women's basketball or to baseball to be competitive? The math is going to look different everywhere across the country.
So if I am a laissez-faire economist and I'm saying, you know what, screw the salary cap, let the market rule. Whoever can pay whatever, let them pay them. Who would be against that? Go ahead.
Yeah, that is a great question. And one, that's against the terms of the settlement. That's something right now that schools really don't want and negotiated with the plaintiff's attorneys to have some sort of cap so we wouldn't have that system. And then or you might have then some schools dropping $60 million and everybody freaking out about parity and fairness of play. But there are ways around this cap, right? The cap just says LSU could only pay $20.3 or $20.4 million a year. Doesn't say anything about Raising Cane's. Doesn't say anything about any particular collective. What the rules of the settlement say is that any commercial deal that is done outside the scope of the school has to be paid fair market value. So what the settlement is saying here is, like, you can't have Raising Cane's pay some left tackle with 20 Instagram followers $5 million. Mm-hmm. Because that's clearly just a way to evade the salary cap. It has to be, you know, in around the same ballpark as what a similarly famous person might necessarily do. But if you're the economist, you might say, well, fair market value is just what somebody would pay. How can you try to figure this out here on a spreadsheet with Deloitte? And the answer to that, my friend, is probably going to mean lawsuits. And that, I imagine, will be litigated in the future.
So name, image, and likeness and the collectives would still exist with this settlement?
You know, probably. And this is part of the complicated math here, because different schools are making different calculations. We had some schools, like Colorado being one of them. There's been a few others that have decided, we're not going to have a collective. We're going to do everything in-house so we can control it, and we can verify that everybody's actually getting paid at the right amount of time, and we're just going to do it in-house.
Wait, who said that? Colorado?
Yeah.
Is that
Colorado
Coach Prime?
Is one of these, yes.
Is that
yep.
Coach Prime or the athletic director, or is the athletic director there?
Rick George is the athletic director. That was a university decision. Okay. And their collective wasn't very big anyway.
So
right?
How do they
move this all in-house?
So if that's the case, how are they not de facto employees of the university?
That is a great question, and the answer is a judge hasn't said they're employees yet.
Okay.
And there are many economists and many labor activists who said, my goodness, if the school's going to cut a check for $700,000 for a small forward on the basketball team, of course they're employees. And that is something that judges are going to be having to address over the coming months and years, and also potentially Congress. Because Congress could just say, I don't care what a judge says. Here's a new law. College football players aren't employees. And then that kind of just settles that.
But now we're getting to labor law and who's an employee and who's contract labor, and then that brings in benefits, et cetera, correct?
It does. And that's a major reason why so many universities have spent so much time lobbying Congress, both previous Congresses with Democrats and Republicans, and also this current Congress, which is, you know, uniformly controlled by Republicans, to prevent exactly that from happening. LSU could LSU could definitely afford a world where every one of their football players is an employee and gets workers' comp and Social Security and all the benefits that come with that. But then doing that for 600 athletes across the entire athletic department becomes extremely expensive. And it becomes probably impossible if you are a Southland school or a Division II or a Division III institution. And so, like, that is something the schools don't want. we're going to have to see if the court system or if the legislative branch agrees with that.
You know, when it comes to benefits, one thing somebody texted in about, and it's a good question, if a basketball forward or a running back or a swimmer or somebody tears a tendon or breaks a bone and they got to go to get medical treatment and physical therapy, prescription drugs, et cetera, who pays for all of that now?
That's a great question. Right now, it's paid for by the school. Mm-hmm. And this was actually a major source of contention among athlete activists and attorneys before the NIL era, because previously it used to be if you were, you know, running back and it's your senior year and you tear your ACL in the second to last game of the season and you have rehab that might continue after you've graduated, that's on you. The school wouldn't pay for it. Mm. Now there are insurance plans to be able to pay for some of the health care for some of those injuries after graduation. But right now, that's one of the biggest expenses for athletic departments across the country is insurance and medical care for athletes who are injured.
How about when did that change, if you had to guess, Matt?
When did it change to be able to add?
Where it's like, well, okay, you know, you're going to play for us, we'll at least insure your health. Or get you healthy.
I want to say this is actually a good question here on the spot. I want to say that that's been covered for athletes during their athletic play since at least the 1980s.
Okay.
But it's a good question. That's something I should look up afterwards.
Because I remember in high school hurting a knee, and I don't remember exactly who paid for that, if it was my parents or if it was the school or what, but that was a long time ago. The question popped up. When you say up to $20 million as a school, where's that $20 million coming from?
Great question. So universities, again, big or small, bring in revenue from a variety of different sources. You might make money from your television contract. You make money from selling tickets and parking spaces and beer and popcorn. You make money from participating and winning NCAA tournament games and from licensing, right? From selling t-shirts and letting people, you know, reproduce your stuff throughout the country. All of that stuff is what we would call earned revenue, and that's where the $20 million comes from. A bunch of economists looked at all that earned revenue across the Power Four and did some plussing and minusing and came up with this as an average. But any school can decide to pay up to that $20 million no matter how much money or where that money is coming in. So theoretically, if you are an FCS institution who plays in front of 800 people in the gym, you could decide to pay $10, $20 million and just take that money from student fees or from somewhere else in the university and split that. All it says is this is the cap. This is how we calculated the cap. Where you get the money to pay for that, that's between you, God, and the Board of Regents.
That's a salary cap per school for every sport, men's and women's, which brings us to Title IX, and we'll pick that up when we come back, all right?
You bet.
I also want to talk more about...
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
About Grant House, the Arizona State swimmer behind all of this, an All-American, an honor student. His days are over, so back pay is going to be a part of this? Is he suing for the people ahead of him? So many questions. And I also want you to address this because somebody texted in and said, 100% do not agree with paying college athletes. And you can tell us a little bit about the historical context of that. We're talking about paying college athletes and name, image, and likeness and salary caps and more. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, is our guest. 504-260-1087 if you have any questions or comments. Back in a flash, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 927, talking to a good friend, Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. How do people find that, Matt?
You can find the Extra Points newsletter at extrapointsmb.com. You can find me at Matt Brown EP on Twitter.
All right, let's talk about Title IX as it relates to this proposed House settlement. Tell me first, for people that think they know about it but don't know of it, tell me about Title IX.
Great question. I think a lot of people forget that Title IX wasn't actually originally created with athletics in mind. But this is the federal statute that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in educational programming. Mm-hmm. What that has historically meant, based on how it's been interpreted over the last several years, is that athletic departments need to provide equivalent numbers of high-level athletic opportunity for men and women. So depending on your enrollments, if you're 52% women undergrad, your scholarship count has to be proportionate there. You can't spend all of your money just on football and men's basketball. Now, most people aren't actually compliant with this law. It tends to only get enforced when somebody sues. Mm-hmm. But schools generally at least make an effort to be compliant with how they distribute and spend money to not be discriminatory.
So give me an obtuse example or something that would be Title IX terribly misapplied, adhering to the letter of the law, that would make no sense. If you can.
Well, so it's funny you mention this, right? Like, an example might be, okay, the football team has 85 scholarships. It brings in X amount of money, and our football budget to account for all of those is $10 million. We now need to spend $10 million on softball, which has a much smaller roster. Like which was a major fear that many administrators had in the 70s and early 80s. That's not typically how it works. But to kind of bring this into what we're talking about now, a couple of days before the Biden administration left the White House, their Department of Education put out a memo that said, listen, based on our interpretation of previous case law, and this is something I heard from a lot of other Title IX litigators, that our belief that the amount of the money that's distributed via this House settlement needs to follow the same equivalency rules for Title IX, which would mean you can't spend 85% of that $20 million just on football and men's basketball. It would need to be equivalent, men and women, like your scholarship spending is. Trump White House comes in, immediately rescind that memo, say, we don't believe that. Which then leads, I think, to an actual difficult situation if you're an athletic director or a university president right now. How do I comply with this law when I don't 100% know who's going to enforce it and what the law is going to be in 4 or 5 years if there's a change in the election? But I also have to win a championship now. It puts them in a challenging spot.
When it comes to women's athletics, softball is now on ESPN. I don't know how popular it is nationally or not. ESPN, I don't mean to demean women's softball, but I was watching Air Guitar the other day, which just because it's on ESPN, that doesn't mean anything. We all know women's college basketball, LSU, it's better. But the women's Lady Tigers are more popular than the man Tigers right now, however you phrase it.
Yep.
So I guess, where's the egg and where's the chicken? Did Title IX lead to the development of the popularity of ladies' college basketball or even softball? Or did the market lead to that? And is reversal of Title IX going to affect any of that or make it less relevant?
So these are very good questions. And in my professional opinion, I think it's impossible to say that Title IX didn't have a role in expanding the popularity for many women's sports, in large part because it helped increase the participation in those sports. Before Title IX, wasn't uncommon at all for high schools throughout the country to not have competitive women's programs. Like, if you wanted to play high-level softball in 1972, in a lot of places, you couldn't. With Title IX and the expansion of high school sports on so many levels and then ultimately into college, you're able to have generations of people who are going to be invested in softball and volleyball and basketball because they've been able to play it for years, which they weren't able to do before. We also have, I think, the push to actually televise and market these events in a meaningful way. And this is something that a lot of women's sports advocates will push back on and say, like, of course, women's basketball does not make as much money as men's basketball right now. You guys had an 80-year head start. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get anybody to put our stuff on television or tweet it, and we couldn't get any reporters. And now we finally begin to do that. Look at that. Our Final Four outdraws you. I think that the truth is probably a little bit of both things, but this would be some of the concern that if you're going to take a strictly revenue oriented approach to how you distribute your money, of course it's going to go overwhelmingly to men. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the women's sports can't become more popular or can't grow. They just didn't have the resources and the infrastructure that the men did over the last several decades.
Where do the Olympics factor in all of this in terms of ladies' gymnastics, volleyball, beach volleyball, some other things that are very popular, basketball, et cetera? Because what feeds what here, Matt?
Yeah, this is, I think, a very difficult and complicated policy question, honestly. You know, something that I think many Americans don't realize is the system that we use to train our athletes for the Olympics, which has been the best in the world,
track
I think,
and field.
For the last several decades.
I shouldn't have left out track and field, but go ahead, please.
No, sure. Yeah, track and field, all of these things. Like, you know, the American system right now really is the envy of the world, but we do it differently than everybody else. What almost every industrialized country does is have a federal, minister of sports, like a federal government program that trains many of these athletes rather than the university system or something that's outsourced. In some countries, the military helps. Sometimes it's the government that pays for it. Here, we've outsourced that development to Division I universities. And men and women from all over the world will come and try to compete at American colleges for swimming and track and field because the training that you're going to get at Stanford or Cal is better than you're going to get at, you know, the National Brazilian Swimming Complex or maybe even in some places in Europe. A major concern right now among so many sport federations, whether that's track and field, swimming, wrestling, softball, the whole works, is if we move to a world where schools now can dedicate even more resources specifically to football and men's basketball, they're going to drop, and we have roster limits for all these other sports, they're going to drop many of these Olympic sports, which do not generate revenue. And if that happens, we will not be as good at the Olympics. We need to come up with a different system to pay for all of these things. And there's a couple of ideas out there right now, but there's not really any momentum towards making any of them concrete policy.
Take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Matt House, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Let me just get this in real quick for the person that said they're against college athletes being paid. Just a 60-second tutorial on the history of that, Matt.
I would say that this has been a debate we've been having for about as long as we've been having college sports, all the way back to the 1890s. College athletes have been paid via the black market since the 1890s, since Yale and Princeton were good at sports. Now the market has evolved and the industry brings in a lot more money. That's where the debate has shifted to now moving forward.
Yeah, analogous to legalized betting as opposed to non-legalized betting. People are saying, well, now people are betting on football games because it's legal when in fact they always were.
I think there's something to that. I mean, a lot more people are betting on football games now than there were before. You don't have to go down to a bookie somewhere in a basement. But yes, this is a market just like for alcohol, just like for drugs, just like for many things that has always existed, regardless of whether it was legal or not.
When we come back, we'll talk about collective bargaining group licensing with college athletes. Did I say Matt House? Did I call you Matt House?
You did, but it's okay. This happens all the time. I got one of those names.
Matt House is an LSU coach. That's where I'm getting. That was an LSU coach. Grant House is a swimmer that's involved in the suit. It's got nothing to do with the House of Representatives, or does it? We'll find out more when we come back. 9:36, traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:43, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Point newsletter, talking about the... When are they supposed to rule on this settlement, the House settlement, $20 million salary cap?
There will be a hearing on April 7th, and Lord willing, we will have some kind of definitive answer a couple of days after that.
But if there is, something's going to be appealed or not?
There's almost certainly going to be litigation following this, particularly about the fair market value and trying to legislate deals that aren't through the school. But what the lawyers that are involved with this tell me is if this settlement's approved, the framework will exist while all of the other lawsuits and appeals process are going on. So, you know, barring something crazy, this will be the system for this coming football season.
And even with that phrase, fair market value, that begs the question, what's fair? To whom, right?
Exactly. Right now, the major conferences have hired Deloitte to help calculate this, indexing against a bunch of other comparable terms. But I'm sure that there will be additional lawsuits from economists and from labor lawyers and from agents. It's kind of a trite joke at this point in this business, but it really is the truth. The most powerful force in college athletics is not recruiting. It's not Alabama. It's not the Big Ten. It's billable hours.
Mm-hmm.
And if I knew exactly how this stuff was going to end, I would not be in the media business.
There's your real winner right there. Billable hours. Let's talk about collective bargaining as far as the athletes go. And would that be by team? Would that be by school? Would it be by sport? By gender, sex? What does that look like?
So these are very good questions. And for people that may not be aware, one of the things that collective bargaining lets you do is create a collective bargaining agreement, or a CBA, that governs the rules for how athletes are paid, how rosters are constructed. It's something that every professional sports league has. So that's why you don't have free agency every single year in the NFL. Like, there's a CBA that dictates this is when you can hit free agency, this is your salary band, and there's rules, and it creates some semblance of predictability. The NBA has this as well, Major League Baseball, everything else. College sports does not have this, and a major reason why is you can't have a collective bargaining agreement or have collective bargaining right now without somebody to bargain with. Mm-hmm. In the pros, there's a players' union. You can't have a union in this country without being employees. And right now, college athletes aren't employees. There's a lot of really challenging legal questions about how you get to collective bargaining, even if you don't have employees, or if you do, who creates that unit. We have some states in the South where public employees can't collectively bargain. So are the athletes employees of LSU? Are they employees of the SEC? Are they employees of a completely third-party entity that's created to get around some of these rules? We don't know. We don't know if the CBA would cover conference football players, sports-specific football players, something wider. All of that has to be hashed out by the people that organize athletes and by a variety of judges, and it tends to be a long, complicated, and expensive process.
Talk about group licensing, Matt.
Sure. So group licensing is important because if you are somebody that enjoys, say, sports video games like Madden or EA Sports College Football 25, the reason that you're able to enjoy those games with the actual New Orleans Saints or the actual players on LSU is through something called a group license, where EA or another video game publisher will go and say, we're not going to individually negotiate 2,000 contracts, or in the case of college football, over 11,000 contracts. We're going to create one big contract, and everybody can either opt into that and get paid, or they can opt out and not be in the game. There's a couple of companies that help facilitate this. I wrote about this today. There's a new one that's trying to break into the college athlete space to give athletes more money for their participation in video games, and to try and make it easier for other video game publishers to use college athletes to make games, potentially a return of the college basketball video game series that's been discontinued, college baseball, other sports. Part of the hangup is figuring out the licensing angle to make sure that all the schools and all the athletes are being paid, because otherwise the game wouldn't be nearly as much fun.
All right, let's say I decide I'm a highly recruited athlete and I'm going to LSU playing football. And they pay me, Canes pays me to do commercials as Tommy Tucker. Can I do commercials as Tommy Tucker wearing an LSU jersey, or can I just wear a purple and gold jersey that looks a lot like an LSU jersey? If I wear an LSU jersey, is that LSU's property? Do they have to get some of that money? Is one part of the other?
Yeah, these are great questions. And the answer is, this is why you have an agent. This is because the rules are often different from school to school. Generally speaking, if you want to do that Canes commercial as Tommy Tucker and you play for LSU, you need to get LSU's permission to have the Bengal or LSU's specific intellectual property in that shot. Sometimes schools will let you have it for free. Sometimes schools say you can use it, but you have to pay the same licensing fee that we charge anybody else. Sometimes they reach a different conclusion. Sometimes they say no. LSU might say, you can't do that because we actually have a university-wide deal with Popeyes. Mm. And, you know, we'll go to licensing jail if our jersey shows up in Canes. So you have to wear a white shirt or something that's not purple and gold. And these are things that get hashed out and kind of litigated in almost every big commercial, because huge universities like LSU and Ohio State and Texas, they have so many commercial relationships. It does take somebody some time to comb through and figure out what are we actually legally allowed to do based on our other contracts.
Talk about college agents and their increasing involvement in this.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, what we just described is kind of a complicated thing, right? To figure out, okay, who owns what intellectual property and how much should I make or charge for this particular commercial? And do I still get paid if I tear my ACL or what if I flunk Spanish or something? These are all difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And they can be hard for college students to figure out. So you typically have an agent or somebody helping you negotiate and follow through with these kind of deals. Part of the challenge is that an agent to represent somebody in the NFL or the NBA has to be certified by that players' union. And that generally means you had to pass some sort of exam. You almost always have a graduate degree. Most of the time you're a lawyer, or you have to have a lot of professional experience. There's baselines to get certified that show I have a minimum level of competence. In college, this market is almost completely unregulated. So you have a lot of people who's like, I have an agent, and my agent is this guy in the dorm down the hall, or it's my buddy's uncle. Or it's somebody that we found from Twitter who's not qualified whatsoever, and they might be charging exorbitant fees. They might be providing bad advice. They might be pushing athletes to transfer every 6 months to try to get more money. And this is a difficult thing for everybody to deal with here. It's frustrating for schools and coaches because it's hard to negotiate with somebody who's incompetent or maybe unethical. And it's difficult for athletes, too, because I don't know about you, Tommy. Like when I was 17, 18, 19, I didn't know that many attorneys. I had absolutely no idea what to ask or how to figure out what a good attorney was. It's the part that's kind of like me trying to find a plumber now. Yeah, I don't know what questions to ask. It'd be pretty easy for me to get taken advantage
that
of.
And that
happens a lot in this world.
And you'd sell yourself without thinking about the future for something shiny right now. And that's
of course.
And the other question I have is, how far down does this go? Is this going down to high school now, name, image, and likeness? Because I think in Texas, big as high school football is, it wouldn't surprise me to see, I'm thinking about Hank Hill and McManaberry, whomever it was, paying name, image, and likeness to a running back or something like that. Does it go to high school or not?
In some cases, it does. Part of that is because, often by the time someone's a sophomore or a junior, you'll know if they have the potential to be a five-star recruit. If you're somebody that's on the pathway to playing in the NBA, you're often a known quantity by the time you're 15, 16, and 17. And so some companies will want to do actual commercial deals with those folks, especially if they're trying to reach younger consumers. But just like the bag men of yore would be interested in paying athletes and developing relationships with them when they were still in high school, so would the boosters or anybody else trying to curry recruiting favor. And in some sports, that actually does make good business sense to target somebody that young, because that's where the influencers and that's where the money is.
Mm-hmm. Who's going to ultimately be the winner and loser here? Do you know?
that's a tough question, Tommy. I mean, like, I think there will be winners and losers.
You know that.
Yeah. And I would say, as frustrating and as chaotic as this era can be, particularly if you're a fan, this is probably not a good time to be a football coach. Mm. It's a great time to be a college athlete. You are able to get more benefits and more money than you ever have before, even if you are not a five-star LSU or Texas football player. There's financial and professional opportunities out there that you didn't have before if you play women's lacrosse or men's gymnastics or men's soccer. And I think that is a net positive. But generally with these things, like with a lot of industries, the ultimate big winners are going to be a lot of the biggest businesses and biggest brands. I would be pretty confident that no matter how the chips fall, LSU's probably going to be fine. Is Tulane? Probably not. Or it's going to be much harder for them, just like anybody else trying to compete in the agency space against CAA or the Wassermans or these gigantic businesses of the world.
If it's not a mess, it'll do till one gets here. Thank you, Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got when we come back on WWL.